From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Congressmember Cynthia McKinney wins the Democratic primary in Georgia.
It's no secret that I am the only woman in Georgia's congressional delegation. And in fact, I have been the only woman in the delegation for the last 30 years that Georgia was without a woman, so I was the first in 30 years. That had meaning to the women in the state, and it had meaning to the women across this country.
We'll talk about McKinney's victory and proportional representation, one way of increasing black representation in Congress. And an outgrowth of the Million Man March, we'll talk with a Chicago minister who will be protesting the Democratic National Convention and is preparing for a national black political convention. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. Reading from the front page of the Washington Post today, the Senate yesterday joined the House in voting overwhelmingly to raise the federal minimum wage by 90 cents an hour after rejecting a Republican attempt to exclude millions of workers from the increase. The 74-24 vote, which followed months of delay and bickering, marked a major step toward enactment of the legislation and provided a rare legislative victory for President Clinton and the Democrats, who have sought to make the minimum wage a defining issue for this fall's campaigns. In the wake of yesterday's vote, a conference committee must now reconcile the differences between the House and Senate version. And Republican presidential candidate Robert Dole backed away from his promises to help repeal a 1994 federal ban on some assault weapons, saying the nation had moved beyond the debate over whether to outlaw such guns. Dole's apparent abandonment of his May 95 pledge as then-Senate Majority Leader to the National Rifle Association's top lobbyist to repeal the gun ban ended a long, delicately choreographed retreat that began soon after he sewed up the Republican presidential nomination fight in March. Some public opinion polls have consistently shown that 70% or more of Americans favor keeping the ban. And this news from Washington, 240 black agents and former agents of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms have won a nearly $6 million settlement in a lawsuit over racial discrimination. The suit, filed in 1990, accused the ATF of bias in hiring, promotion, and evaluation of blacks. It said most black agents were assigned to low-ranking jobs and kept out of executive positions. Each of the current and former agents involved could be awarded nearly $20,000. And this is how the Washington Post described the story on the front page today. Larry D. Stewart, a U.S. Treasury agent, can still remember the chill he felt when an undercover assignment went bad and a gunrunner put a .357 Magnum revolver to his head on a summer night in 1982. Surviving only because the gun failed to fire, Stewart also remembers how he felt the next day. He said, "I asked myself over and over, why would I put my life on the line for an agency that would let agents call me nigger?" He went on to say, "I had a training supervisor call me nigger, supervisors called black custodial workers nigger, telling jokes using the word nigger." And tomorrow night at 9 o'clock, Court TV will air the documentary Mumia Abu-Jamal, A Case for Reasonable Doubt. After HBO aired the program on Sunday night, Philadelphia's Fraternal Order of Police called for 500,000 active police members nationwide to cancel their HBO subscriptions in protest. And last night, Bob Dole spent the evening at a baseball all-star game with Pennsylvania's Governor Tom Ridge, who signed the death warrant for Mumia Abu-Jamal. Meanwhile, yesterday, members and leaders of the NAACP poured scorn on probable Republican presidential candidate Bob Dole for breaking tradition and failing to address their group, the oldest civil rights body in the country. But it wasn't exactly breaking tradition, at least for Republicans. President Bush didn't address them 4 years ago. Dole's campaign cited a scheduling conflict and offered to send former Housing and Urban Development Secretary Jack Kemp to the NAACP National Convention. The NAACP refused. We also got a fax from the Bob Dole for President campaign, which said that he did have a major scheduling conflict, and also said, "With a great civil rights record that includes vital service as the floor manager who steered the Martin Luther King Jr. National Holiday Bill to passage in the Senate, Bob Dole has spoken out forcefully on those who seek to divide our country and pit Americans against each other." President Clinton will be addressing the NAACP National Convention at 4 o'clock today. Also, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will be addressing a joint session of Congress this morning. He will then be giving a major speech at the National Press Club. We'll be having more on that story tomorrow. Congressmember Cynthia McKinney, Democrat of Georgia, won her primary in a landslide victory last night, taking 67% of the vote in a race against three white male challengers. McKinney represented a majority black district until the Supreme Court ruled it was the result of racial gerrymandering and declared it unconstitutional. Most of the seats held by members of the Congressional Black Caucus are under the same threat, and some are worried the redistricting will nearly eliminate black representation in Congress. Cynthia McKinney and her colleague Sanford Bishop, another African-American Congress member from Georgia, are running for re-election in a redrawn majority white district. Both won their primaries last night, but perhaps the most difficult battle lies ahead in November when they face Republican challengers in a part of the country where white Democrats have flocked to the GOP. I caught up with Cynthia McKinney by phone at her victory party last night at just about 1:30. It was just the time that she had received the word of her victory.
Well, of course, we're just overwhelmed and ecstatic. We put together a coalition that works not just for this district, but really that works for America. We brought together black and white, young and old, and because of our experience, we were able to bring together the urban and the rural. So we stand for a coalition that wins for Georgia and that wins for our country.
What exactly was your strategy?
To put together the kind of coalition that we were able to demonstrate that we had and take us over the top. That was the strategy.
What about your focus on women?
Well, of course, it's no secret that I am the only woman in Georgia's congressional delegation. And, in fact, I have been the only woman in the delegation for the last 30 years that Georgia was without a woman, so I was the first in 30 years. That had meaning to the women in the state, and it had meaning to the women across this country.
What kind of support did you get from women? Do you know the breakdown of the results right now yet?
Oh, the results were absolutely fantastic, overwhelming. The people of the district spoke today, and definitely women demonstrated that they want representation and they want the kind of representation that I provide.
What kind of support did you get from women outside of Georgia?
I got great support from women. I was endorsed by each one of the major national women's organizations.
Democratic Congressmember Cynthia McKinney, she won her primary yesterday in a majority white district in Georgia. Some, including McKinney, are advocating new ways of voting in the U.S. that could remedy the underrepresentation of minorities in elective office. It's called proportional representation, an idea that killed Lonnie Guinier's nomination to head the Civil Rights Division at the Justice Department. We'll talk more about redistricting and proportional representation with Pacifica National Affairs correspondent Larry Bensky and Rob Ritchie of the Center for Voting and Democracy. But first, this song for Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney. Water Lilies doing Helen Reddy's I Am Woman here on Democracy Now! Cynthia McKinney just flew into Washington this morning. We're wondering if she'll be whistling this while she works today. Well, joining us now to discuss Cynthia McKinney's victory, the issue of redistricting and proportional representation, is Pacifica National Affairs correspondent Larry Bensky at Pacifica station KPFA in Berkeley, and Rob Ritchie here in Washington of the Center for Voting and Democracy. And why don't I get from both of you, starting with Larry, your reaction to Cynthia McKinney's victory, as well as Sanford Bishop's, both in Georgia.
I'm very surprised by the magnitude of Cynthia McKinney's victory, Amy. It seemed to me when I was down there and reporting on that district back in March that she was going to have a much tougher race. And for her to have won two-thirds in the primary, of course, we don't yet know things like voter turnout and where those voters were and what percentage of women and African-Americans voted, et cetera. But still, this is a very impressive triumph because of several things. One, she was facing two popular politicians, one, Comer Yates, sort of a Faulknerian southern name, had run before in a district that was part of this new district and had very good name recognition and had a decent amount of financial support. One of her other opponents, Ron Slotin, who had the wonderful lawn signs, "Voting for Slotin," had, again, a lot of name recognition. He's a state senator that represented a part of the district that is overwhelmingly African-American, although he isn't. And I thought that both of those people were popular enough so that they might force her into a runoff or at least deny her something like the overwhelming victory that she won. But Cynthia McKinney has a lot of things going for her. For one thing, she's an extremely bright, very hardworking, and very articulate person. And I think a very sincere person who connects very well with the electorate. And the other thing, of course, she had going for her was the advantage of incumbency and money. It's going to be very interesting to see the campaign finance reports that come in on Cynthia McKinney. I understand that she spent over $400,000 in this primary. And that gets you a lot of ads. It gets you a lot of lawn signs. It gets you a lot of walking around people. She also had a very, very well-organized volunteer operation of several hundred young people, principally college students. The district includes Emory University. And it was a strong multiracial coalition of people who walked precincts for her. And finally, she had the thing that she mentioned in that little interview you did with her, Amy. She had overwhelming women's support. And this is not something that I think the mass media look at closely enough. It's that she is the only woman in the Georgia congressional delegation, and she's the only person who's been in Congress for several decades from Georgia who's a woman, and I think a very, very strong feminist. And this, again, we're maybe seeing here a little foretaste of what we may see in November as far as a very, very strong woman's vote supporting women candidates.
You know, I also think, Larry, that with people thinking that she would lose or maybe be in a runoff, there's an underestimation of the black support as well as women's support. Also, Cynthia McKinney will go on in the next few weeks to fight for her arms code of conduct that she and Oregon Republican Senator Mark Hatfield have been championing for the last few years, which says that the United United States government should not be selling weapons to human rights abusers. Well, let me get your reaction, Rob Ritchie of the Center for Voting and Democracy. Is this what you expected, this huge landslide victory for Cynthia McKinney?
Well, I think it's great that she was able to win by that margin. My one cautionary note is that actually the demographics of the district in the primary were probably very much in her favor, that most black voters in the in Georgia are going to be Democrats, and the current black voting age population in the district, I've heard, is around 35% to 40%. If you figure a lot of whites are Republican now, then she had a large majority of the Democratic electorate. She may even have had a 60% or 70% black voting turnout in the primary.
Didn't this new district also include a bit of Newt Gingrich's old district?
I'm not sure if it did or not. I think it's one that's winnable for her though in the fall. And that's and an interesting point about that is that if she were to win, or if Sanford Bishop were to win, or I guess Corrine Brown from Florida is also going to be running in a white majority district, they would be the first black from the South, or the only black right now, to be representing a white majority district. However, coming in as incumbents does give you some of the advantages that Larry mentioned. But I also think it just that once they've gotten in the door, what the Voting Rights Act did above all was get people in the door by creating an access that once they were in, people could look at them and see how they acted and see that whites could look at them in a different way. And I think that for Cynthia, probably the key will be how white women look at her. The fact that she is the only woman in the Georgia delegation and the only woman from the state in 30 years, I thought that was a sort of dramatic fact, and I'm hoping that has some power.
Rob, one of the things that Cynthia McKinney has been advocating, of course, is a change in the entire electoral system, a change that you advocate as well in your Center for Voting and Democracy. And one of the reasons we were very anxious to have you on this morning, and I hope have you on several more times on Democracy Now! Over the course of the next few months, is because there's a great deal of agitation on the part of people who are discontent with the current political system, who want to change not only how the money is used in the system, et cetera, but how the system elects people. And my email buzzes almost daily with people saying, why don't you have more talk about proportional representation? So here it finally is. We mention it in passing sometimes. Can you explain to our listeners in the simplest way possible, and I know that there are various different types of plans, what proportional representation would do and does in other countries to change the way people are elected in a democratic society?
Well, I think probably the defining difference between a proportional representation system and our winner-take-all voting system is that it lowers the percentage of votes that it takes to win a seat. And by doing so, that creates a situation in which basically voters in self-defined groups, whether that's by party or by race or just however they vote, will be able to help elect representatives in the proportion to their share of the voting electorate. So in a party-based systems, where say most countries in Europe use these party-based proportional representation systems, if you have a 10-seat district, so you meaning that you have 10 representatives, and a party gets 10% of the vote, then it gets 10% of the seats, which is 1 out of 10. If it gets 50% of the vote, then it gets 5 out of 10 seats. That you win seats in proportion to your degree of support. Now, in a winner-take-all system, 51% of the vote can easily win all 10 seats, or in any sort of particular single-seat district, 51% of the vote can basically suppress any chance for representation of any group in the minority.
Rob, which countries have winner-take-all system and which countries have proportional representation?
Well, it's a lot easier to list the ones that use winner-take-all because there's rather few of them. It's basically plurality systems. Just one little distinction between the winner-take-all systems is one in which you need a majority to win, like France has a runoff system where you have to get 50% in the second round. And then there are just a handful that use what we have, which is a plurality system. Whoever finished first wins. And it's interesting. It's just Great Britain and its former colonies. It's Great Britain, Canada, and the U.S., and India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, some former British colonies that just certain. And what happens is you just sort of inherit the rules that you have before. And we often don't step back to question the fundamental rules and the impact that they have. But almost every country in Europe has proportional representation. The only exceptions are France and Great Britain.
We are talking to Rob Ritchie, who is with the Voting and the Center for Voting and Democracy. You put out the Voting and Democracy Review. We'll get the number of how people can get a copy of that in a minute. We're going to go to a break, and then Larry and I will be back here on Democracy Now! This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here in Washington, D.C. Our national affairs correspondent, Larry Bensky, is out in Berkeley. And we're joined by Rob Ritchie, who's with the Center for Voting and Democracy. We're talking about proportional representation on this morning after the victory of Cynthia McKinney and Sanford Bishop, two African-American Congress members in new districts in Georgia. In fact, Cynthia McKinney, Rob, has a bill on the floor called the Voters' Choice Act. What is that?
Well, the Voters' Choice Act is a very sort of easy first step, I hope, for proportional representation, which is basically to give states the right to use proportional systems to help elect their congressional delegations, which is actually relatively recent that they can't do that. In 1967, there was a law that mandated states use single-seat districts, these one-person-representing-each-district systems, and that back in the early 60s, a state could have used a proportional system, and it's basically restoring that status quo where states have the option, when the next redistricting cycle comes around, to use a proportional system. And so that I think that there's an opportunity to have this bill reach across the parties in that it is creating options, it's not mandating options, and we'll have to see. But I think that if we had that kind of bill, we could see a lot more activism at a state level. All of the states that have initiative rights, the ones that pass term limits and so on, could go straight to proportional representation for Congress. What's exciting is that all those states, of course, could use proportional systems just by doing citizen initiatives for their state legislatures. And that's something that we're going to be talking much more about. And I think that the potential for this movement really is exciting in that it can bring together people who often don't work together, basically people across the spectrum right now who feel disenfranchised, and everyone who is basically being manipulated in the current redistricting process. And I think we often skip over the way congressional districts and state legislative districts are drawn, but it has such a powerful impact on who wins and loses that everyone, the majority included, is very much affected by that.
There are times when I wish Pacifica was television rather than just radio. There aren't many times, but this is one of them because I think this really lends itself to graphic demonstrations with charts. But one of the things I think listeners need to grasp, Rob Ritchie, and perhaps you can help them, is the difference in the different kinds of voting that lead to proportional representation. There's limited voting, there's cumulative voting, and there's preference voting. And there's a great debate that, again, I follow online about these three different types of voting. Could you briefly tell listeners which of these three you prefer and why and what it is?
Well, I'll try to do that briefly. We don't have much time, and I think that the key for listeners is that proportional representation in general is a principle that we can work for at every level of government. For instance, right now in San Francisco, next week the Board of Supervisors will be voting on whether to place preference voting on the ballot for the Board of Supervisors. That's actually, of those three systems you mentioned, Larry, that's the one I think would work best. It's what they use in Cambridge. They use it in Ireland. They use it for the Senate of Australia. The gist of it is you rank candidates in order of preference, and your vote will go to the highest-ranked candidate who can win with that vote. And the more seats that are elected, the fewer the votes it takes to win. And we could get more into how it actually works, but for a voter, it simply means ranking candidates in order of preference. And it basically lowers the threshold and creates some other sort of positive dynamics. One quick way you can think about preference voting is that you could use it in our presidential elections. In fact, any state right now could go to preference voting for this fall's election. And it would be, say, if Ralph Nader is on the ballot in many states, that in California, a voter could go into the polls or go into the ballot box booth and rank Ralph Nader first, right, maybe rank Bill Clinton second and Bob Dole third, and that you would need 50% of the vote to win, and if no candidate received 50% of first-choice votes, the last-place finisher would be eliminated, and you would reallocate those votes to whoever's next. What that would do is free people up to vote for Nader, who right now are going to be worried, saying, well, he's not going to win. Am I voting for someone who is going to maybe help Bob Dole win? And it sort of takes away that lesser of two evils dynamic.
Well, what about San Francisco for a minute? You have a city with 11 supervisors elected right now at large in the city. Frequently, people, 25, 30, 40 people run for, let's say, the five open offices that they have there this year. Mm-hmm. Would a person going into the voting booth have to rank all 40 people? Wouldn't this lead to tremendous delays and all kinds of complications electorally?
They would have the opportunity to do that theoretically. Actually, in San Francisco, they are talking about limiting the number of choices, which I don't think they should do, because the principle of the system is a lower choice will never help defeat a higher choice. And almost everyone is going to help elect one of their top one, two, or three choices. Like in Cambridge, they have a 9-seat city council. And something
this is
like
Cambridge.
Cambridge, Massachusetts uses this system. They've used it for quite some time, and it's actually worked very well there. It's an interesting example of where you have ideological minorities on the council. You've had blacks on the council for 40 years, and you know it is a success story there. But that something like 70% of voters will help elect their first choice, and that's it. So that they really actually didn't need to help elect anyone. They didn't need to rank anyone else. But by doing so, it gives them more of a chance if their first choice doesn't win.
We're talking with Rob Ritchie of the Center for Voting and Democracy here in Washington, D.C. Now, Lonnie Guinier was pilloried for these ideas. And she was so extensively badmouthed all over that I don't think people understood proportional representation at all. Is this what she was putting forward?
Well, she was talking also about cumulative voting, which is another candidate-based proportional systems. And those three systems that Larry has mentioned are all candidate-based rather than the party-based systems that they use in Europe. And I think that we might want to look at some of the party-based systems when we're talking about state legislatures, for instance. But I think she was race baited, and that they use this as a vehicle to race bait her, and that they could have done it for the next nominee as well, who is a strong supporter of the traditional remedies of the Voting Rights Act. But the irony is that this is a colorblind solution to the problems of the Voting Rights Act, and yet she was race baited. She also, I think, was unfairly criticized for just raising some ideas about what can a minority on a legislature do to have influence, to look at maybe power sharing or something. And she was talking about the context of, say, a 5-member county commission in Alabama where blacks are 25% and could help elect one person, but then once they're on the council, 4 out of 5 are white and might just totally isolate that one candidate. So she was looking at things that then people said, well, she's trying to subvert majority rule. She's trying to do what we do in the U.S. Senate, filibusters. You know. But there was a whole set of things that she was attacked for. I think it's interesting. Actually, her views on cumulative voting drew some surprising support from people who otherwise were against her nomination, but they actually supported her interest in cumulative voting.
Being in Washington, D.C., you know that the first preoccupation of any elected official in Washington is usually to get reelected. And if you're going to change the system under which they're elected, and by the way, in certain countries like France, they change the system all the time. Sometimes it's proportional, sometimes it isn't, depending on who's manipulating the levers of power. But aside from that, when you talk to politicians in Washington that you want to get interested in this, I'm sure they come at you and say, what's this going to mean to me personally? What do you say back to them if it looks like it might cost them their seat?
Well, there actually are, I think, interesting arguments you can use for almost everyone. But it is true that congressional incumbents are not going to be wildly excited about changes like this. However, we do have the state initiative process, which, say, term limits wasn't something that they were very much excited about, but we were able to get that passed in many places. And campaign finance reform is another one. But I think that proportional systems basically would do a lot for politicians who feel frustrated in the current system, and they can feel frustrated too.
Rob Ritchie, how did you get involved with this issue of proportional representation?
Well, I worked on some traditional campaigns, worked for someone who I think was a very good member within the context of the current system, but I was just quite frustrated with some of the limitations to how she was forced to operate, not because of what I think she really believed, but because of the dynamics of her district and needing to get 51% of the vote. Basically, it's very hard to lead with new ideas that don't start out with majority support. And that's what I mean by access for Cynthia McKinney. I think that she may win this fall because she's already there and people can hear her ideas and get excited about them. But it's hard to even get on the first step, you know, to get things going. I think for any new party in this country, they absolutely need proportional representation because otherwise they can't get that first step. They can't get a foot in the door.
Any final thoughts, Larry?
Well, one final thought is that if there really is a reform party in the United States, it should be considering reforms like this. And I wonder if Rob Ritchie has talked to either Ross Perot or now Dick Lamb about this and see if it can get some national hearing by being taken up by a national figure.
We've actually talked to some folks very close to Perot, and there really is some interest, actually. And Dick Lamb also is pretty close to John Anderson, the former member of Congress who was our organization's president. And John has talked with him about these ideas. I think that this is an idea that's new enough that if they're really thinking of trying to win this year, they might be a little worried about it. But I think that there are some access is being made.
In fact, Ross Perot is going to be on Larry King Live tonight, and he often makes major announcements on that show. We'll see see if Dick Lamb will have some competition for the presidential nomination on the Reform Party. How can people get in touch with the Center for Voting and Democracy and get your newsletter?
Well, they can probably the easiest way is to contact us at 202-828-3062.
Again?
828-3062.
And that's in the 202 area code.
Or they can send a quick email to just CVD, Center for Voting and Democracy, CVD at essential.org, O-R-G.
That's CVD at essential.org.
And they should support the Voters' Choice Act with their member of Congress, and they should just take a look at whether these ideas could be implemented actually at their local level. It's something that often can be done.
Rob Ritchie, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Rob Ritchie with the Center for Voting and Democracy here in Washington, D.C. In a few minutes, we'll be talking with an African-American minister who is going to be protesting outside the Democratic National Convention, and he's also going to be a part of the Black National Convention. Larry, thank you very much for joining us. And now, tune from the Foreman.
What did you do on election day, oh dear brother of mine? What did you do on election day, my darling brother? I kicked the pamphlets off the porch and read the latest Forbes and Fortune, went to work on my tan, felt distinctly disenfranchised, threw my Bee Gees records away. That's what I did on election day. That's what I did last Tuesday. What did you do on election day, oh dear sister of mine? What did you do on election day, my darling sister? I met the girls at the courts, wrote a note to Arnold Schwarzenegger, caught up on my soaps, pinched my cheeks and dashed my hopes, threw my sample ballot away. That's what I did on election day. That's what I did last Tuesday. What did you do on election day, oh dear father of mine? What did you do on election day, my darling daddy? I cashed my check and cleaned my gun, read Cal Thomas and the Funnies, made a payment on my plot, thought a thought I've since forgotten, threw my recycling buckets away. That's what I did on election day. That's what I did last Tuesday. What did you do on election day, oh dear cousin of mine? What did you do on election day, my distant cousin? I voted.
What?
I voted yes on ABC, no on WXYZ. Tore my stub, drove home, and then back to the polls and voted again. And again and again. Once for everyone who stayed away. That's what I did last Tuesday. Otherwise a real slow news day.
What did you do on election day by the Foreman from their CD, What's Left, here on Democracy Now! Last October's Million Man March was given momentum to a range of local, has given momentum to a range of local activism in African American communities around the country. In a moment, co-host Salimu Akil will join me, along with Reverend Al Sampson, the chair of the Million Man March Committee of Chicago, to talk about his group's plans during the Democratic National Convention this August and his work on an upcoming National Black Political Convention, another outgrowth of the Million Man March. But first, last month, African American women in Los Angeles held a Million Women March. And even though the event wasn't attended by a million women or even thousands of them, it was a time for African-American women to rally together around common concerns. Pacifica's Robin Urovich was there and filed this report.
Million Women March!
The so-called Million Women March and conference drew a much smaller crowd than expected, but that didn't dampen the enthusiasm of those who did show up. As the group assembled for a march around the conference site at LA's Exposition Park, Lynette Miles Gibbs of the Black Women's Task Force of Phoenix says it was the event's theme of strengthening the bonds of the family that struck a chord with the members of her group.
When you look around and look at the conditions of our society now, that's very important. Everything starts with the family.
society starts with the family. So you have to go back to that. What I hope will come out of this, that first, that it's not just a one-day event, that we all go back to our communities and really try to make a difference in providing support and providing workshops and providing information on how to become better parents and how to unite our families together.
Some said the gathering lacked the political and emotional punch of last October's Million Man March on Washington. The L.A. chapter of CORE, the Congress on Racial Equality, led by African-American Republican Celis King, and Freedom Journal, a local publication focused mainly on promoting black business, sponsored the event. And while the majority of attendees were women, some of its key organizers were men. Most of them said it was the Million Man March that inspired them, but there were two messages heard above the rest. Over and over again, speakers like State Senator Diane Watson urged the crowd to help defeat the anti-affirmative action measure on California's November ballot, deceptively titled the California Civil Rights Initiative.
I want to be sure that every person eligible is a registered voter. If you are not, get up and leave this park. You have no place here. Because that's the only way you can make your voice heard in government. And I want to be sure everyone here goes out and votes against CCRI. That's the California Civil Rights Initiative. That little child that Celis King introduced to you, his future is of grave concern to all of us. When she graduates from high school, will she be able to go to the University of California? Will she be able to get in a corporate position?
And many speakers preach self-help, self-reliance, and positive thinking. Here's former Assistant Secretary of Agriculture under President Carter, Dr. Joan Wallace.
I grew up in urban America in Chicago, Illinois, and I was fortunate to have parents who said to me, "Yes, you can." My dad was born in 1884, and he said to a black girl, "You can be the president of the United States if you just work twice as hard as everybody else." Well, I didn't quite make it to being president of the United States, but I came five steps beneath the president. That's because my parents told me, "Yes, you can." And I didn't even know there was sexism out there. I just knew about racism. I'm glad nobody told me about sexism, because I'm not sure I would have been able to say, "Yes, I can."
With the exception of State Senator Watson, elected officials were notably absent, and the march failed to draw high-profile speakers. Betty Shabazz, widow of Malcolm X, was invited but did not attend. And while no agenda for the future emerged, most participants said they were grateful for the information and inspiration, just disappointed that more people didn't come. I'm Robin Urovich, reporting from Los Angeles.
And thanks for that report, Robin. Tomorrow on Democracy Now!, Congresswoman Maxine Waters will be joining us to talk about a town hall meeting on affirmative action to counter the CCRI, the California Civil Rights Initiative, that she's holding this Saturday in Los Angeles. We'll be back in a minute. Thank you. I'm Amy Goodman, and Salim Wakil joins me now on Democracy Now!, along with Reverend Al Sampson, the pastor of the Fernwood United Methodist Church of Chicago and chair of Chicago's Million Man March Committee. Before we start, Salim, I just wanted to say that you had a very good piece in the last issue of In These Times, which you're a senior editor, the cover story, Burning Hate, on the church burnings.
Thank you, Amy.
Very good piece.
It's a crucial issue. I think we should all pay much more attention to it. We are here on Democracy Now!, but across the country, I don't think enough attention is being paid.
It'll be interesting to see at the end of August if the Democratic Convention, if they'll be talking at all about the church burnings and remedies. But why don't we go now to Reverend Al Sampson and talk about what your plans are for the Democratic Convention.
Yes, I just want to say good morning to your listening audience and to both of you, especially my brother Salim.
Good morning, Reverend Sampson.
There's several steps before we get to Washington. July 26th and 27th of this month, we're going to Kennedy King College for a national public policy hearing. As a result of the Million Man March, we have over 300 cities across the country where activity has been going on, like it has in my church, every Monday and Wednesday night. We've had Million Man March meetings. And so those delegates will be coming in from our organization called the Million Man March Committees, local organizing committees. They're going to be bringing their particular recommendations for an agenda. On top of that, we've invited various nationalities and other political groups. The Arab community will be invited with their caucus, the Hispanic community. We're inviting the Indian community, the Asian community, so that they can have a caucus of expression. All of that would be placed into a document that Friday and Saturday, with a Friday night town hall meeting that'll be done on the campus of Kennedy King College here in Chicago. The Reverend Dr. Al Sharpton will be coming in town this Friday night for a mass meeting strategy leadership meeting, because he has a national group that he's putting together called Cash the Check. And that grows out of the August 28, 1963, when Martin King not only had a dream on his speech, but he also said that this government has sent us back a check marked insufficient funds. So Al Sharpton is saying 30 years later, we want the check to be cashed. And then Dave Dillinger is putting together a group for the day of the demonstration. Al Sharpton's demonstration is going to be August 28th. As you know, the convention is August 26th through the 29th. And Dave Dillinger, who was one of the original Chicago Eight back in 1968, they're putting together a group called Not on the Guest List, which is a very interesting
Reverend Sampson, you spoke at the Million Man March, and mm-hmm. you've been involved in the civil rights struggle for several years. In fact, you started with Martin Luther King, from what I understand. Much of the talk that came out of the Million Man March was in terms of political mobilization of the African-American community. There was a plan for the agenda conference, which you're talking about, which you say will be at Kennedy King on July 26th and 27th?
That's correct.
And there
Friday
was also
night and Saturday night.
Friday and Saturday. Mm-hmm. And there was also talk of perhaps mounting an alternative convention following the convention of the two major parties. Has there been any more discussion along those lines?
Yeah, we plan on doing that. We haven't tied down the time, date, and place, but we do know that the process is that we're going to come up with a legislative agenda, bring it to both the Republican and the Democratic Party, and then hold our own convention for lack of a better word, Convention of the Oppressed, sometime in September. One of the things we're attempting to do as we move our people into what Minister Farrakhan called a third force and not a third party, but to become a third force, we're trying to solidify and organize people with their ideas and with their power base. One of the things that people have to realize is that the Million Man Marches will end up in October being 1 year old. So we're the newest organization on the block. And when you have a mobilization like we had, and then you move into program like we've done, then you have to move toward what we call consolidating your gains. And so the initiatives that we are doing on the local level, bringing them in July 26th and 27th, begins organizing them politically, because a lot of the delegates that are in the, both the Democrat and the Republican convention were participants in the Million Man March. Mm-hmm. So they will go to the convention. I was talking to a friend of ours the other day who is key inside of the national and local Democratic Party. He's going to give me the list of all of the black delegates in Illinois, plus the list of the black delegates from across the country. We're going to be asking two or three of them to come in July 26, 27. So when they're on the delegates' floor, they will have our agenda. These initiatives are really designed to organize our people into a third force. 2 weeks ago, I was in Springfield, Massachusetts, speaking at a black family day to about 4,000 or 5,000 folk that was organized by the Million Man March. As you know, I celebrated my 40 years in the ministry last week, Friday, and I flew out that morning to Springfield. Ben Chavis was my guest speaker, and Reverend Chavis flew to Baltimore, Maryland, where over 5,000 to 10,000 people came out in another black family day march. So all of these initiatives that have been moving around the country is geared towards solidifying and consolidating our base. I was on the national tour. As you know, I was the only minister that went with Minister Farrakhan to Africa. January and February, and we solidified some deep-seated relationships there.
Reverend
Sampson.
And
then we came back and did a United States tour in Los Angeles, Detroit, Boston, and New York, and we hit about 8 cities.
Reverend Sampson, I just wanted to ask, since you mentioned that you were on the Africa tour of Minister Louis Farrakhan, just a week ago, Salim and I talked to two Baltimore Sun reporters. I would assume that you've heard about these three pieces that came out in the Baltimore Sun about slavery in the Sudan. They went there, actually, an African-American reporter and a white reporter, and they found a slave market, and they bought two slaves and freed them. And they've been trying to get in touch with Louis Farrakhan, but he is not responding, although he put out the challenge to journalists. Let's see if you can go and find them, because he was very much supporting the Sudanese government. What are your thoughts on that now?
Well, it's real simple. Minister Farrakhan, we have it on tape because we took our own film crew. We went to the Sudan. I personally asked the president, was slavery in his country? He said no, there was no slavery in his country. Minister Farrakhan has always spoke out against slavery, said it there in the Sudan at the international press conference. It's amazing that they're attempting to find it now when there have been several regimes in the last 8, 9, 10 years regarding that. I think it's a non-issue. In that
slavery,
let me finish. You can't lay the question of slavery at the door of a black leader like Minister Farrakhan or myself, and those of us who are in the community of liberation, when we've been fighting against it, and still, by the way, fighting against it, when we see the chain gangs that are occurring in our prisons, for us that's slavery. When we see black children in Chicago who get access to guns and drugs and not to computers, that's a whole level of slavery. So we just feel that there are always forces in the world, in the country, that attempt to chip away at the credibility of one of the most important black men in the world since my friend and the man who ordained me in the ministry, Martin Luther King.
You have to remember, Reverend Sampson,
that I'm the only one that ended up not only being ordained by Dr. King, that was a part of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, but I made the motion that we accept Minister Louis Farrakhan at the Million Man March as our worldwide leader. And Time Magazine came 6 months later and agreed with me that he is the most influential black man on the planet Earth. And
Reverend Sampson,
he happens to be a Muslim. Mm-hmm.
Reverend Sampson, I don't really want to belabor this point, but I think it's important because in New York City, for example, there's a lot of dispute now between people who think that the issue of slavery in the Sudan and in Mauritania should be more forthrightly addressed by African American leaders in this country. And
nobody argues that. I mean, we think that Mandela ought to have the gold and the diamonds, and people ought to stop buying gold and diamonds up and down economic main streets in black and white America
until
the brothers and sisters. I mean, there's a lot of issues.
Sampson,
the bottom line is that shouldn't be laid at the door of Minister Farrakhan.
I'm not saying it should be laid at his door, but the point I am making is that it should be much more forthrightly discussed among black leadership, and it appears to be some sort of attempt to squash the argument.
I don't think it's a question of squashing the argument. I pointed out when we were there, I personally asked the question. I was the guest of Minister Farrakhan. And I asked the question in front of my guest. And I asked the question to the president. I mean, it's on tape. I knew we had discussed that we had to clear it up. I got a letter the other day because we did a computer conference at Chicago State. And I got a letter the other day from the Sudan. A group of us do plan on going over there and seeing for ourselves. And we do plan on challenging the government. But you have to remember that there's a small group of us on the leadership level. I mean, if you start calling off names, Salim, you know more than anybody else. There's, what, about 20 of us, 30 of us, 40 of us, 50 of us?
Mm-hmm.
You know, somebody can take the issue to the Congressional Black Caucus and have them raise questions. Somebody can take the issue to the Sudan. I mean, I'm sorry, to the United Nations.
Mm-hmm.
And raise the question.
You're not against the issue being raised and discussed vigorously then.
Nobody has. In fact, there's been debates with Akbar Muhammad and some of the brothers.
Well, there was a serious debate on this radio program between Akbar and Nate Clay, who's leading a struggle.
Right.
And the
only problem is Nate hasn't been, and Akbar went, and what we have is a lot of folk who claim they've gone. Now, I don't know who these reporters are. I don't know about them buying of the slaves and all of that. I don't know how much of it was staged.
I don't know anything about that.
The point I'm raising is there had been, while we were there, there had been this kind of move, even during the Million Man March organizing, that because it was a Muslim who was our leader, named Minister Farrakhan, and because Sudan is a Muslim-based country, and Sudan participates in slavery, therefore, ergo, you know, make the big leap that Farrakhan is a part of the process.
Okay.
And that's all the thing we're reacting to.
Reverend Sampson, okay. I don't think that the issue was being laid at Reverend Farrakhan's feet. I think that he raised the issue by denying that there was slavery, and that's why this has become such a major issue.
Madam,
yes.
It was at his doorstep.
Well, because he said that there wasn't slavery there.
Well, I said it, too. And it was before he said it. is what I want you to hear. There's a history of this. This is anything that just started when you saw two reporters come back from Baltimore. I'm telling you, for the last year and a half, and Salim, you know this, during the mobilizing of the Million Man March, they were trying to find 18 different ways of discrediting the minister. One of the ways that they did it on the international level was to associate the Muslim piece with the slavery in Sudan and the Mauritania and lay it at his doorstep. We had discussions about all of that. When the Million Man March was over with, and African governments started contacting him because the Million Man March had more impact on Africa than it did in some quarters in America. When we went on the trip, we were invited by all of these African governments because they wanted to commend us and they wanted us to help them with their tribal differences. When he and I went as Christian Muslim, and I was in several of the mosques, and he introduced me as his Christian brother, and that I gave him the keys to my church in 1979 when there were mosques in America that wouldn't give him the keys to rebuild his nation. They gave me standing ovations.
Reverend,
because in a lot of these countries, there's tension between Christians and Muslims.
Reverend Sampson, let me change the subject for a second just as we're coming to the end of this conversation. Would you be for an African-American political party?
I don't understand what that means.
The idea of African-Americans leaving the Democratic Party, feeling that it's not serving them and forming a kind of a third force outside the Democrats.
Well, you're saying two different words. You said third force, and we are building a third force. It is unrealistic and very romantic to talk about a third, quote-unquote, African-American party if you understand the political system in America is based on the Electoral College. It's based on congressional districts. The more fundamental question you might want to ask African leadership is, will we have the right to vote? Because the way the Southern-based decisions are coming out of Uncle Tom on the Supreme Court, the whole question of congressional districts are going to have to go back to the drawing board based on the cases that have just been adjudicated in, Georgia?
Georgia, Texas,
Alabama.
North Carolina.
And we're hanging in the balance on Alabama and Mississippi. Let me hasten to say that Reverend Ben Chavis talked with us yesterday in our strategy meeting.
Reverend Sampson, I'm going to have to cut you off. I'm sorry to say I'm going to have to cut you off because we're going off the satellite now. Reverend Al Sampson, chair of the Million Man March Committee, thanks for joining us. And, of course, Salim, thank you very much. Folks, if you'd like a copy of the show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And tomorrow on Democracy Now!, we'll be speaking with California Congressmember Maxine Waters. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Hello, I'm Diane Rehm, Secretary of Defense William